Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sentencing reform was at the center of issue one on the statewide ballot in Ohio on Election Day in November, calling for drug addiction treatment when needed instead of prison time. That measure failed by a 2-to-1 margin, but the issue is alive and well. President Trump has said he would sign sentencing reforms into law at the federal level. Some fellow Republicans in Congress, however, have been less enthusiastic. New York Times congressional correspondent Nicholas Fandos has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the proposed package of reforms has been introduced on a bipartisan basis in the Senate. In general, you wrote, the reforms would unwind federal tough-on-crime policies enacted in the 80s and the 90s. Like what?
I would say begin to unwind.
Okay.
This is a more modest bill than was proposed and gained bipartisan support a couple of years ago during the end of the Obama administration. But it would shorten some mandatory minimum sentences for non-violent drug offenders. It would clarify what's called the stacking provision, which says if you have a firearm on you when you commit a federal crime, like a drug crime, your sentence can be kind of multiplied. Makes some other changes to give judges more discretion in using or applying mandatory minimum sentences. And then it extends retroactively a change that was passed a few years ago, which lowered the disparity between crack and powder cocaine. Most of those changes would only affect criminals going forward rather than backward, which is what somewhat limits their impact.
A sticking point on issue one in Ohio had been that it would limit judicial freedoms. The federal package would give judges greater freedoms. How so?
Well, it would give judges what are called additional safety valves, which allow them in certain circumstances to go around the mandatory minimum sentences that the law lays out. So if the judge felt that there was good reason to avoid a mandatory minimum for a certain drug offense, they could do that in certain circumstances. Now, that's actually one of the things that's proven somewhat divisive, not between a kind of equal halves of the Senate, but there's a small group of conservative Republicans who don't like that provision, among others, who feel that it will soften things too much and let offenders, get off with a lighter sentence.
In Congress, why this change of heart, Nicholas Fandos?
Well, I don't know that this is necessarily a change of heart within the last couple of years. I think over the last two decades, we've seen folks both on the right and on the left look back at a slew of policies that were adopted in the 80s and the 90s federally and across the country that were meant to get tough on crime, to clean up drug and gun violence, but in reality have created a big incarceration problem in the country, put a lot of people in prison. The data suggests pretty clearly that these laws have disproportionately put black offenders behind bars rather than white offenders. And, you know, I think that the right and the left have somewhat different reasons, but they both boil down to something about fairness. Conservatives also think that this is a kind of big government intrusion and not a wise use of resources to be imprisoning people for life for offenses that they don't consider as grave as they once did.
You mentioned the tough-on-crime policies from the 80s and the 90s affected African-Americans at higher rates than white offenders. Why was that, and why is that?
Well, because they they penalized the kind of drug crimes that are more typically committed by African Americans at a greater rate, and because they tended to set up a kind of dynamic in the criminal justice system where black offenders were more likely to be stopped, arrested, and actually prosecuted for, in many cases, some of the same crimes that whites might be committing in a different context.
Even the Koch brothers on the right and the ACLU on the left are attracted to this package in Congress right now, right?
That's correct, yeah. I mean, a bunch of different groups in between.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, that gets back to the point I was making earlier. Mm-hmm. For the Koch brothers, this is really about use of government resources. Mm-hmm. They feel that it makes, you know, if they're going to advocate for small government, a small federal reach in other areas, for, you know, intellectual integrity and consistency, they need to do so in this area as well. The ACLU obviously has, you know, bigger concerns about racial justice and about rehabilitation of criminals and unfairness within the system.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about prison sentencing reforms. Issue 1 failed on the Ohio statewide ballot earlier this month, but there are plans afoot in the Ohio Senate to introduce another package of bills that might get to some of the same problems. My guest right now is New York Times congressional correspondent Nicholas Vandos, who covers these issues in Congress. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reluctant to take it up right now?
Senator McConnell's stated reason is that we're sitting here now with less than 3 weeks on the calendar until this Congress is supposed to adjourn for the end of the year holidays and basically the end of this Congress. So, and there are other priorities. There's a spending bill that needs to be passed. There's a major farm bill that's waiting to be passed. He would like to pass some more judges. So he says simply, you know, I don't know if we have enough time on the calendar to do this. Now, he has deeper concerns than that, though, and they essentially come down to he does not like to bring issues to the floor that divide Republicans. And nobody quite knows where the dividing line on this one will fall. There's definitely a substantial number of Republicans in the Senate supportive of the bill, but there are some vocal opponents, and I think he worries that it opens Republicans to some political vulnerabilities if they don't stick together on this. So this week there's a what we call up here a whip count going on, where essentially the Senate leadership is taking a measure of support for the bill. And I think that will go a long way in determining whether or not this bill ultimately gets a vote.
He said he wants 60 votes.
That's what he said in the past. I would guess that he is likely looking for a threshold that's higher than that, though. Most, almost all, if not all, Democrats are expected to support this bill. So theoretically, you could get to 60 with just something like 11 Republicans. Mm-hmm. I think he would want to see more Republican support than that if he's going to move the calendar around to bring this up.
This is mostly moderate Republicans that are on board for this, not that conservative branch.
Well, you know, it's a little difficult. It's a little
that's what they're
I mean, the you know, some of the champions of these bills we would call very conservative in other areas. Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is the lead author of this bill. He, you know, has overseen a big part of Republicans' effort to get conservative judges onto courts, including the Supreme Court, and is very conservative in certain areas. Mike Lee, another Republican who's involved, is considered to be very conservative in some areas, though tends to be more libertarian, which I think is behind his interest in this. Mm-hmm. So it, you know, it's created unusual alliances, including you know, President Trump, who, you know, perhaps is not a natural champion of this issue, but has thrown his support behind it and has been lobbying Mr. McConnell to put on the floor. Paul Ryan is I should also just say the Speaker of the House is also a big proponent of these changes and wants to see this done before he retires at the end of the Congress.
You know, you call it kind of unnatural alliances, but these are the sort of alliances that in the past would get things done.
That's exactly right. And I got to say, it's kind of refreshing as a congressional reporter to be covering an issue that brings together Democrats, Republicans in ways that are not strictly partisan. It makes it much more interesting dynamic and frankly, I think probably produces better legislation.
You know, you wrote that you know, you mentioned that similar overhaul with bipartisan backing, including President Obama and Speaker Paul Ryan, appeared destined for success in 2015. What happened then?
So, you know, it's hard to point to any one factor. In that case, Mr. McConnell, again, refused to bring it up for a vote in the Senate. We were in 2015, 2016, obviously in a presidential election cycle. Donald Trump came onto the scene and really began to kind of change the conversation around crime in some of these issues. If you remember, he ran a very tough on crime campaign, and Mr. McConnell, you know, essentially felt, I think, that the politics were not right for Republicans at that moment to be supporting changes that, while they have the support of, you know, polls suggest are pretty popular, potentially expose Republicans from criticism on the right that they're being soft on crime.
Is that attitude starting to change in general? Do we know if it's starting to change out in the greater American
hinterlands? If you ask advocates of these kind of changes that question, they would say certainly, and they would point you to polls that they have taken that show many of the kind of changes that we're talking about, both the sentencing and to setting up programs that are meant to better rehabilitate people to reenter civilian life, are wildly popular. They'd point to several states, including southern and conservative states, who have adopted many of these changes on the state level and seen success, and say that, you know, this is basically the federal government playing catch up, and it's about time. They certainly think this bill is a good first step, but only a first step, as the name suggests. And that the hope is, among advocates for this, is that the federal government passing these changes would spur more states to do so on the state level, and it would create a kind of feedback loop where you'd begin to unwind a little bit more of these policies that they view as unsuccessful and overly costly.
And ultimately, even at the federal level, how many people would these reforms, if enacted, affect anyway?
Well, it's hard to put a precise number on it. For the sentencing changes, you're probably talking about a number in the low thousands. That number would have been bigger if the changes were to be applied retroactively, i.e. to people who are already in prison. But that's not the case in most of these provisions. On the prison side, it's more like tens of thousands of people who could benefit from job training, vocational training, programs that would be put in place and funded, as well as an expansion of early release programs. So that's a little bit bigger number.
Yeah, and you
but
meant,
it's also important to say this would not affect people who are in the state state prison systems,
it's
and that's actually where the majority of the incarcerated population in the U.S.
Is this bill funded? Would it be funded, or would it have to go through an appropriation process afterward?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't immediately know the answer. I don't think that it's my understanding is that its cost outlays are not that big, and that large portions of it pay for itself.
Okay. Well, Nicholas Fandos, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You bet. Nicholas Fandos, New York Times congressional correspondent. We've been talking about efforts at the federal level in Congress to reform sentencing laws, particularly for drug offenders. We're going to kind of drill down into the state question of that, particularly in Ohio. So if you have a question or comment moving forward, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sentencing reform was at the center of issue one on the statewide ballot in Ohio, calling for more treatment instead of prison time. The measure failed, but President Trump said earlier this month that he would sign a package of federal reforms into law. That is, wouldn't help or affect those in state prisons who make up the vast majority of the incarcerated in the United States. We're talking about the pros and cons of prison sentencing reform in the U.S. Joining us is Ohio State Law Professor Douglas Berman. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also, by phone, former state senator, former Ohio Supreme Court justice, and current executive director of the Ohio Judicial Conference, Paul Pfeiffer. Welcome back.
Oh, good to be with you, Ann.
Justice Pfeiffer, judges and elected Ohio Republicans called Issue 1 a flawed proposal that didn't belong in the state constitution. Outside of the constitutional issue, which is debatable, but, you know, another issue, how was it flawed?
Well, I'd take up your whole program going through the ways it was flawed. Yeah, the judges actively worked community by community to defeat it, not just because it was in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one unifying piece to it. But it, I think the Cleveland Plain Dealer editorial page writer summed it up. It was a chainsaw approach to something that would be better served with a scalpel. For example, mm-hmm. It brought substantial quantities of the most dangerous drugs down to a misdemeanor for which you couldn't even go to jail until your third conviction within 2 years. It allowed everyone in prison to get up to 25% shaved off of their sentence if they engaged in certain programming. So that let's just take that one.
Mm-hmm.
That included the most dangerous people that we have in our prisons, of which there are a substantial number. The talk of the proponents was, this is just for low-level offenders who are in prison and shouldn't be. Well, there aren't that many of those. Of the almost 50,000 people in prison, under 5,000 are there on drug offenses. For example, and that was part of the focus of it. So, but I don't want to chew up your whole program.
Well,
that's in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
It was defeated badly. It should have been. And we're trying to be forward-looking at
this point. What should sentencing reform look like? What should be the primary goal of it? What's the point?
Well, the point of sentencing is to get bad people, dangerous people, off the streets. Then when you drop down, the debate focuses really, and I don't think there's much dispute about that. And
mm-hmm.
what's that population? Maybe 15,000, maybe 20,000 top end. And so the rest are going to be there for shorter periods of time. They've committed a variety of crimes, and so you can focus on the drug offenses if you want to. The judicial conference, the judges supported an effort, a couple of year effort. It's called recodification. It's like a 4,000-page report, chaired by Judge Pebble, that had several legislators on it, and we would still think that that's a good starting point to begin discussions on changes in our sentencing structure. So that's where we would start. So then we can get into specifics. Hmm.
Doug Berman, who are the stakeholders in all of this these days?
Oh, I think the entire society and every person within it is a stakeholder about the operation of our criminal justice system. And I think it's a great question because where you look at the system, your experience with the system very much shapes where you think the inevitable balance needs to be weighed. And so if you've been a victim of crime, there's a tendency for crime victims to be more vocal in saying we need tougher sentences, we need to make sure victims' voices are heard, and concerns about dangerous people getting out of prison too quickly and the risk of new victimizations, that's emphasized by some segment and a number of individuals who actively advocate in the criminal justice system. But if you've had a family member who's been sent to prison, or you yourself have experienced the criminal justice system, you often see firsthand how much of a blunderbuss it can be, how even though we take pride in our constitutional system of rights that defendants get before being sent to prison and what happens in prison, in reality, there are a variety of forces that make it awfully easy for a number of low-level offenders to be subject to really severe sentences, maybe get very long prison terms. The time in prison is counterproductive, not just for the individual, but for the family and the community. And so we're hearing, especially, and perhaps it's an inevitable force in place, as more and more people have been impacted as persons sent to prison, sent to jail, have family members, friends that are, and see how destructive that can be, they're starting to speak out more and more about the need for the variety of kind of reforms, the federal reforms that were spoken of earlier in the program, the Issue 1 reforms that even though they didn't pass, we heard many people across the political spectrum saying there are good ideas in here, we just need to make sure we do it the right way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of sentencing reform today. You just heard from OSU law professor Douglas Berman, also with us by phone, former Ohio Supreme Court justice, former state senator, and now executive director of the Ohio Judicial Conference, Paul Pfeiffer. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to hear from people who have had interaction with the judicial system in this way when it comes to sentencing, and tell us what your experience has been. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We had a message on Facebook from Nathan. He said that he was glad that Issue 1 was struck down, but he went on to say, if you look historically, when blacks were arrested at a higher rate during the 80s and 90s because of drug crimes, there was no sentencing reforms in place. No one was calling it a public health crisis. Now that white people are being arrested for heroin at a much higher rate for drugs, people want to label it an epidemic and now want to change laws as if it's a health problem and not a crime problem. It's totally a reflection of the deep-seated marginalization and unfair treatment of minorities in this country that people don't want to talk about. You know, Justice Pfeiffer, you were a senator back in the 90s when I was covering these three strikes and out, you know, this get tough on crime thing. Everyone was running for sheriff. What were you thinking at the time?
Well, I was gone from there when they did the three strikes and out. I've never been a fan of that. Yes, things did get carried away. But I think the comment of your listener is dead on. When it was the bad boys in the hood dealing crack with each other, there was no interest in, you know, there was a discussion that the penalties for crack and dealing crack were more severe than the penalties for cocaine, which was a substance that I guess is, you know, we hear about it in use by the rich and famous and the Hollywood crowd and all that, but it's everywhere. So I think that is a legitimate criticism, but clearly today, if the subject is drug offenses, it now is pervasive at all social economic levels, and yes, my sense would be that has suddenly stirred interest on the right and the left because nobody wants their kids or their grandkids to end up in prison because they've become an addict, and I think some of the changes that we will see will and should enhance the opportunities to divert these folks. So they're already there, but even greater opportunities to direct them into treatment. And if they get serious about treatment and turn their addiction around, to make a criminal record go away or to never have happened. So treatment in lieu of incarceration or in treatment in lieu of conviction, we think should be expanded, give the judges greater latitude in directing people in the treatment. But I just had an exchange yesterday with David Mattia, one of our common pleas judges in Cuyahoga County that's run a drug court for a long period of time. He's been highly critical of the medical community and maintains that every hospital should have both an outpatient and an inpatient ward to deal with them, so that in communities, in the more rural communities where treatment opportunities aren't available, they become available. And he points out a number of details where he feels the medical community has just come up short in dealing with this.
It's an expensive proposition. You know, Doug Berman, are we putting the cart before the horse? Are we calling for more treatment when we really don't have the resources to pay for it, let alone have the treatment to buy in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have we have the resources. We found the resources to expand incarceration. We found resources to do a variety of other kinds of programming if we made sustained commitment to treating this problem as a public health problem rather than as a criminal justice problem. The resources are potentially available, and in fact, that's one of the things driving sentencing reform and prison reform is a realization over the years of how costly incarceration is and how counterproductive it can be, how evidence shows over and over again that time in prison can be what we'll call criminogenic, meaning make it more likely that you'll come back and commit more crimes. The recidivism rates are very, very high, even as we've cut back on programming without a recognition. This is especially what's being focused on at the federal level, was part of issue one, having more programming to ensure that when individuals come out of prison and back into the community, they're prepared to be productive. But drug treatment is a huge component of that, something that's been missing, something that's been, again, underfunded in part because we've focused on other priorities. Though, I think part of what you're rightly saying is there's no silver bullet to drug treatment. There's no easy fix. There's no
standard
approach.
Particularly with the opioid epidemic.
Any part of the drug problem, right? And so we see this. We're seeing increase in meth issues, and that's back on a horizon.
Yeah.
A range of other drugs, you know, come and go through various cycles of use and abuse. And what we've learned over time is there isn't a snap your fingers, this is the proper model, or even that there's a one-size-fits-all. Even if we throw money at a problem, different individuals with different background concerns will need different kinds of treatment. That's a lot of hard work. One of the reasons I think we've moved towards mass incarceration is that feels like a one-size-fits-all answer. Well, if there's a person who's a problem in the community, you lock them up, they're out of the community. But it proves to be costly over time.
Most of them return to the community.
You know, almost all of them will, yes.
Ultimately.
It's a question not just of whether, but how. And that's why the prison reform part in both the federal bill and that was proposed in issue one ought not get lost as we continue to talk about these drug crimes and how we treat them on the front end with sentencing.
Yeah. And Paul Pfeiffer, you made the salient point that most people, the low level offenders already are getting out relatively quickly. But what that adds, that kind of exacerbates another problem. Even if you provide treatment in the prisons, the way they're shoveled in and out at that lower level, they don't have enough time to get anything done.
Well, I think the judges favor drug addiction is your principal problem, and it's usually not the only problem, because by the time they end up in court, they're committing other crimes. They start stealing from their family to support the habit, and then they branch out from there. So they are a problem in the community, and they are a criminal problem in the community in addition to their addiction, generally. The judges are very supportive of give us and leave us with the tools to direct people into treatment. I'll take, for example, the ad that the proponents, who wasted $8 million of somebody's money on television ads, only to lose 2-1. One of the ads was a grieving father, and I knew we would see that. And his statement was, well, if my son could have only gotten treatment earlier instead of incarceration. Well, his son was never incarcerated. His exposure to court first came on a criminal charge, but he was clearly an addict. So he was directed to be tested and evaluated, and he was guided into programs one after another. And he just, you know, he was one of many who they're not ready to give up their addiction to these powerful drugs that are now on the street. So it has to be a combination. There needs to be retained in this scheme the ability of courts to remind folks, we'll guide you into treatment. We'll try to see to it that it's the appropriate level of treatment, whether it's inpatient or outpatient. But there will be consequences if you don't do it. And as many of the seasoned judges who work with this say, the failure rate can be fairly high until a person hits bottom and finally accepts the notion that they need to try to turn their life around and try to get free from the drugs. And as these drugs become more powerful and there are new powerful drugs coming at us all the time, it's going to be a constant battle. And the death rate in Ohio is shocking at this point.
Yeah.
I think, there are a lot of things that we don't know. How many addicts do we have? If we lose almost 5,000 people last year, can you interpolate from that how many people in the state are addicted to the most serious drugs, the drugs that are hardest to free yourself from? I don't think anybody knows the answer to that.
Well, and I'll chime in, and this is something that Sarah Andrews, the director of Ohio's Criminal Sentencing Commission, has been emphasizing in the discussion about Issue 1. We really need a lot more data, particularly data related to what happens to people when they're not sent to prison. So the anecdote that mm-hmm. the justice was talking about, we have data on who goes into prison, for how long, what they're there for, but we don't have an awful lot of data on when judges choose to use alternatives. We heard lots of statements by both the proponents and the opponents of Issue 1 of this is what happens, that's what happens. But significantly, they couldn't cite data because we don't have good data on those issues.
They don't keep track of those
things. It's very hard to keep track of it. Again, it's a little bit of a will rather than a way that we commit ourselves to gathering better data about these issues. And particularly, again, I think often the problem is we go into it hoping, and it's understandable that legislators would do this. If we do this one program, that'll give us an instant answer to these sets of problems, when in fact there are some, deep social conditions that are driving, many challenges with drug use and misuse. There's also mental health issues that are so complicated here as well. And so, hopefully among the things that will come out of the post-Issue 1 conversation and that the General Assembly will work on is not just passing new laws, but making sure we continue to identify data gaps and seek to fill them so that we have the best information possible moving forward, recognizing that that information isn't going to provide an instant answer, this was what we ought to be doing, but will just help us make more informed decisions.
We're going to continue our conversation. We're talking about sentencing reform. My guests, you just heard from Douglas Berman. He's an OSU law professor, also with us by phone. Paul Pfeiffer, former justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, former state senator, and now executive director of the Ohio Judicial Conference. And we'll have another guest as well, coming from the point of view of families affected by the rampant incarceration that exists in the state of Ohio and across the country. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the pros and cons of prison sentencing reform in the United States and Ohio. Still with us is OSU Law Professor Douglas Berman. Also with us by phone, former Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, former state senator, and now Executive Director of the Ohio Judicial Conference, Paul Pfeiffer. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Giving more latitude to judges, resisting the urge to catch everything in stone, doesn't that create something of a patchwork quilt of justice across the state, too? There are going to be some judges who like to throw the book at the defendant and others who want to work with them and find treatment.
Well, no, you can put some parameters around that, but... you know, the focus is, well, different judges do different things. Well, yes, they do, but there's a lot of training and a lot of boundaries that are established by the legislature on what you can do. One suggestion that is bouncing around right now is on first time drug possession offenders, mm-hmm. where they have small quantities that would presumably be just for their personal use. I mean, where that argument begins to fall apart is when someone's found with
fentanyl, right?
Well, or when they're found with, you know, the typical addict lives day to day. So yeah. When they're found with a pretty sizable stash, they're not just using. They're dealing or trading, using one of the judges I've talked to frequently about this problem is men use drugs to get women addicted and become their sex slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of gradations of all of this, but to require that the first opportunity is that you are ordered into treatment in lieu of conviction, and if you go into treatment and you stay with it, your criminal charge disappears, so you never have the record.
Hmm.
That's an option, and I think instead of just throwing around this mass incarceration bull that I that's just a convenient term. Mm-hmm. The 49,000 people that are in prison are all there for a variety of reasons, and it's foolish to treat them with a blanket indictment of the system. But the thing it seems to me there is consensus on is for people who become addicted, and drugs we treat differently than alcohol, I think principally because it's so much more difficult to freeze oneself from these very powerful drugs, and the downward spiral in your life for you, for your family, for everyone, for your employer, everyone around you, happens so much quicker, and for many, their life ends in a relatively short period of time, unlike alcohol.
Hmm.
I think that's probably why we treat it differently when you're just talking about someone who's addicted.
Huh.
But the goal is and should be to, if we're going to treat it as a health problem more than a criminal problem,
mm-hmm.
then it is how do we get them through recovery and not come out the other end with the barriers to employment and to housing that exist. And I think there's really across the board agreement that we need to improve the ways that can happen.
Joining us by phone now is president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. That's a nonprofit organization in Washington, D.C., working to change penalties, what they call inflexible and excessive penalties. Kevin Ring, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What about there's lengthy prison terms are expensive. What do we know about the rehabilitative qualities of a long haul behind bars?
Well, there's not good evidence that prison is rehabilitative. And, of course, this varies from prison to prison and the federal system, the state prisons, and even within the state system. In a lot of state systems and the federal system, wardens are operating fiefdoms and have different rehabilitation efforts underway. But overall, we know that drug treatment for somebody who's truly addicted or whose crime sprung from addiction, drug treatment is a much more cost-effective approach to reducing crime. I think that's why you see it supported by a broad spectrum of organizations, you know, from the Koch industries and to the Soros on the left side and in between and groups like ours. We just have a different view of this than we did 30 years ago. In our country, we thought, you know, drugs were a moral failing and that, you know, everybody deserved to be punished. And now we realize we've got to use our resources wisely. And prison is for people we're really scared of and not people we're just mad at. And so if somebody is suffering from drug addiction or some other trauma and can be treated in a way other than being behind bars, we should do that.
Let's see. I'm turning to Stephen in Cincinnati. You're on the air. Stephen, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about, you know, what the prospect might be for in the near future, you know, what the guests think about setting a goal for reducing incarceration. I mean, one way or another, we can all acknowledge that our prison population in Ohio, just like around the country, has skyrocketed. And it's not like crime has skyrocketed at the same rate in any way. You know, crime's gone up and down. It's down, actually, over the last several years. And so why do we have to keep consenting and sort of mealy-mouthing our way to excusing this 50,000 people in state prison? Can we set a high goal, that is like, or let's say a low goal, of reducing the prison population by 10, 20, 25%?
Yeah. That's a different way of looking at it, Stephen. Douglas Berman, is there any evidence that that's a goal out there?
It certainly is among some advocates. So there's an organization called Cut 50 that is sort of avowed to have the federal or the national prison population in the U.S. cut by 50%, that would still put us higher than most Western industrialized countries. Wow. And still put us higher than we were 40 years ago. And so there certainly is no magic perfect number. And that's why the term mass incarceration is often used, is because we're not just the world's leader in incarceration per capita, but we're history's leader in the level of incarceration that we have. And it is, I think, fully a function of our society turning away from what had historically been a view of prison as a last resort to now prison as a first resort. And I think that that, in some sense, still was reflected in the vote on issue one, that, gee, when police and judges say we need to be able to send people to prison to deal with these drug problems, that still resonates. And so, you know, the caller's suggestion that, gosh, could we just put in a number, you know, whether it's 10%, 20%, where we really have a target for reducing our prison population. I think that's something that is possible, but I don't get the sense that there's a real keen affinity for that approach, save for the fact, and we saw this in Texas a decade ago, if we have a price tag on what it would cost to keep growing our prison population, that often can be what drives at least an interest in keeping prison populations from growing. In Ohio, I don't know if I want to give it credit, but at least has tried not to grow beyond that 50,000 number, which we've been at for a number of years.
Right.
You know, we could be, were the past growth pattern still in place, up to 70, 75, and I guess we should be grateful we're not there. But I think the caller's right to say, ought we not think about bringing that down, not just keeping it where it is, if we really do recognize the harms that prison can cause and the degree to which, I think the justice said, there's 5,000 people in prison for drug offenses. Well, there's 5,000 right there that issue one's authors, at least I think, had in mind moving them out of prison into some place that could be more cost effective.
Yeah. Kevin Ring, do you like taking that perspective on the equation that we're talking about today, looking at it from changing the final number and seeing how we can get to that?
I think it's somewhat arbitrary, and I think that, as Professor Berman has said, you know, people think what they want from the criminal justice system is public safety, and that's still their primary goal. And if you can show them that you can get to a low number of incarcerations while keeping the public safe, or in some cases safer, which I think you can, then that's a worthwhile goal. But I think sometimes when advocates start talking about, you know, cut 50, I mean, not everybody shares that goal. I mean, people don't know what that means. Most people don't even know what the prison population is. Most people think crime's going up when it's going down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of getting public, you know, support for some arbitrary cut in the prison population is probably not the best approach. The best approach is one that says the things we're doing right now aren't working. We can be safer and have a lower prison population. And, of course, dozens of states around the country have reformed their systems, have reduced spending on prisons and their prison populations, and seen crime go down. That's all positive. Texas is a good example of that. We need more of that. It's going to take a while. But part of the job is on people like me to build public support for that view. I mean, it's hard to go to politicians and people who are elected, especially after what happened in Ohio, and just say, hey, look, just start cutting prison population. I mean, that's not where the public is yet, and we've got to get them there.
Stephen, thank you for that call. And one more call from Andrew in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Andrew. We're running out of time, so I don't want to rush you, but that's
And how are you doing?
Good.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.
So what I wanted to bring up is, for all of these discussions for getting drug abuse and drug addiction and alcohol addiction, I'm going to add in, looked at, I don't really hear anyone on the side saying that. What have we heard from people who have had to go through this treatment? What do they say works? What do they say definitely doesn't work? You know, because myself, I'm an alcoholic. I've had to go through this. And, you know, it's not an easy thing to go through. And it's really something that I feel like we can have a voice that helps things get better, helps people feel better and faster and be more effective. So I just wanted to bring that up.
Okay. Andrew, thanks a lot for that call. We're just about out of time. Kevin Ring, you know, you've talked about, you know, you represent, you know, you're president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Why was this group formed? I mean, what does it have to do with families ultimately? We know it hurts families, but why pick on the mandatory minimums?
Well, mandatory sentences are really the most offensive way that we impose long sentences, because what we say is, I mean, usually in this country we think if you commit a more serious offense and you're more culpable, you should get a longer sentence. If you're, you know, if your offense is less serious or you're less culpable, you should get a shorter sentence. There should be some proportionality. Mandatory sentences replaces that idea with a one-size-fits-all. So you could be the top man in the conspiracy or you could be the low man and you still get the same long sentence. So it's the most noxious of ways that we get to these long prison sentences.
Okay.
And, you know, and so our view is people should get punishment that fits the crime, but only their crime.
I want to thank you for joining us, Kevin Ring. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Ring is president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums. It's a nonprofit that operates out of Washington, D.C. Also, Douglas Berman, OSU law professor, thanks as always for joining us on this topic.
Thank you, Ann.
And Paul Pfeiffer, executive director of the Ohio Judicial Conference. I appreciate your time, Justice.
Good to be with you.
And everybody else for listening. Thank you so much. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.